in some capacity, Katharine Hepburn and Henry Fonda. But these days, his client list boasts Christopher Jones, Olivia Hussey, Sally Kellerman, and two out of the three members of the pop trio, Dino, Desi, and Billy. He repped the juniors, Desi Arnaz and Dean Martin. The property was a pretty good investment. He lives in the guest house out back and rents out the big house to Hollywood high flyers. As he approached the wide open front door, which is really the side door, the television set plays a black and white rerun of the TV series Combat. The opening credits of the show flash across the screen, and the series' military theme blares out of the speakers. The deep-voiced announcer announces, "Combat, starring Rick Jason and Vic Morrow." His dog is excitedly barking at the small, in stature, shaggy figure on the other side of the screen door. As Rudy reaches the visitor, he shouts at Bandit to calm down, grabs him by his collar, and pulls him out of the way. The damp man in the bathrobe looks through the screen door and realizes he recognizes the man on his doorstep.
"Rudy?" Charlie asks.
"Yeah," answering a one-word question with a one-word answer. Charlie goes right into it.
"Hey, Rudy, I don't know if you remember me. I'm a friend of Terry Melcher's and Dennis Wilson's."
"I know who you are, Charlie," Rudy tells him without any warmth. "What do you want?"
This dude ain't too friendly, Charlie thinks, but at least he knows I know Terry. "Well, I came down to talk to Terry and the dude at the house that Terry moved."
"Yeah, they moved about a month ago," Rudy confirms. Charlie does a little frustrated dance, kicking at the grass and the ground, cursing, "Gosh dang it, dag nabbit. Looks like I came all the way down here for nothing." He then turns back to the man behind the screen door and asks with a big, open face, "You know where he moved to or his number?"
"I really gotta get in touch with him. It's kinda an emergency."
Which, from Charlie's perspective, isn't a lie. But Rudy lies to Charlie when he tells him, "Yeah, sorry, Charlie, I can't help you with that. I don't know."
"Well, that's a drag," Charlie says.
Changing his tone, Charlie asks the man behind the screen a question he already knows the answer to.
"What do you do for a living, Rudy?"
"I'm a manager, Charlie," adding, "You know that." As Vic Morrow, Rick Jason, and Jack Hogan blast Nazis in the background, Charlie goes right into his rap before Rudy Ottobelli can give him the brush off.
"Well, the reason I gotta get in touch with Terry is Terry was arranging an audition for me with Columbia Records and tapes. But the truth of the matter is, I don't have representation. So if all goes well with this audition, and they want to sign me to a contract, I'm all by my lonesome. And you know that ain't the best situation for an artist, especially against some commercial giant like Columbia Records and tapes. So maybe I could come back, play you some tapes of my songs, maybe play for you a little on my guitar. You like what you hear, you sign me up, and I start my relationship with Columbia Records and tapes on the right foot." Charlie sees Rudy isn't interested, so it's time to bring out the catnip.
"I hang out with a bunch of girls. Maybe bring them around. They sing background. Everybody always has a good time with my girls. You ask Terry.
You ask Terry. He's had himself a goddamn good time with my girls."
Rudy starts to open his mouth, but before anything can come out, Charlie shoots him a question.
"Have you heard the new Beach Boys album, 2020?
"No."
"Well, I got a song on it," Charlie informs him. "I wrote the song," he qualifies. "And Dennis Wilson tinkered with it, fucked it up. And the Beach Boys fucked it up even more."
"Look." Rudy tries to cut in, but Charlie doesn't let him.
"In fact, they fucked it up so much, I'd rather you not listen to it. I'd rather play my version of it. Maybe come back, play my tapes for you, play a little on my guitar. You know, just make up some songs. I'm real good at that.
Charlie says sincerely. Finally, Rudy gets out.
Well, I'd like to talk to you longer, Charlie, but I'm leaving for Europe tomorrow, and I gotta pack.
A big smile spreads across Charlie's face, and he says with a giggle in his voice,
Well, I guess this is just my shit luck day, ain't it?
Now it's Rudy's turn to change the subject. How did you know to come back here? Charlie jerks his thumb over his shoulder.
Dude at the main house sent me back here.
Look, Rudy Altobelli sternly instructs. I don't like my tenants to be disturbed. So from here on in, you don't bother them again. You got it, Charlie? Charlie grins wide and waves his hand in compliance.
I get it, I got it, and I'm good, Charlie assures him. I don't want to be no bother.
Trying to wrap up this whole exchange with a little dignity, Charlie says,
So I'm gonna go track down Terry, or he'll track me down, and maybe at another time I can play some of my songs.
Finally, Rudy thinks.
Yeah, Rudy says, sure thing, Charlie.
Charlie gives the man behind the screen a big wave and an even bigger smile and says,
Happy trails!
Up on top of Rick's roof, Cliff's got Rick's TV antenna back up again. He's twisting some wire around the base with a pair of pliers to keep it in place when he spots the little hippie dude he saw drive up in the Twinkie truck leaving the Polanski residence, walking back down the driveway in the direction of the automobile. As Cliff continues to twist the pliers, he follows this sketchy dude with his eyes. Charlie's just about to climb aboard the Twinkie truck when he feels eyeballs on his shoulders. He pauses, then turns around. He sees, staring down at him from the roof of the house on the opposite side of the street, a blonde guy with his shirt off, working behind a TV antenna. The two men are too far away to get a good glimpse of each other. Charlie smiles one of his big face-covering smiles and gives a shirtless blonde bloke a big wave. Cliff doesn't smile or wave back. He just stares holes through the dark little hippie while he twists the wire around the antenna with a pair of pliers. The smile disappears from Charlie's face. Then suddenly, Charlie breaks into one of his ooga booga dances, complete with yelled Manson gibberish. When Mr. Manson finishes his spastic dance performance for Cliff, he flips off the asshole on the roof.
Fuck you, Jack!
Mr. Manson climbs back in the Twinkie truck, starts it up, shoves the broom-like stick shift into gear, and pops and coughs down the hill of Cielo Drive. Cliff watches him leave, then says to himself out loud, What the fuck was that? Chapter 12. You can call me Mirabella. The door of the makeup trailer on the set of Lancer flies open, and out steps Rick Dalton. Except he doesn't look much like Rick Dalton anymore. Sonia put a brown Indian wig on his head, which she cut into shoulder-length locks, and spirit-gummed a big droopy Zapata-like mustache around his mouth. And Rebecca put him in a groovy brown rawhide jacket with a Custer-like fringe dangling off the arms that wouldn't be out of place if Rick was performing on stage at Woodstock with Country Joe and the Fish. In other words, Caleb Descartu a la Sam Wanamaker. Sam, Sonia, and Rebecca couldn't be happier. Rick ain't so convinced. But Sam is so enthusiastic about both Rick as an actor and his conception of a counterculture Caleb that the actor thought it best not to rock the boat. So he decided the best plan of action was to be as good an actor as Sam thinks he is, by acting as if he's enthusiastic as the other three about the development of Caleb's look. In reality, Rick thinks,
I look like a cross between a goddamn hippie faggot and the cowardly lion from The Wizard of Oz. And he's not quite sure which of the two he dislikes most. Sonia pops her head out of the makeup trailer door and warns him, Rick, I know it's lunch, but you need to wait at least an hour before you eat. Give that glue holding your mustache on your lip a chance to dry. Nice guy Rick gives her a no-sweat-baby look, pulls a Western paperback out of his back pocket, and waves it at her in demonstration. No worries, honey. I got my book. Great, Rick thinks. I'm fucking starving, and now I gotta miss lunch. One of the things Rick likes about working on a set is they have to feed you. Rick thinks any meal not paid for or prepared by him is a good meal. A lot of actors he crosses paths with on a set are ingrate sons of bitches. What's not to love? They pay you a lot of money for pretending. They feed you. They fly you places. They put you up. Give you spending cash. And do their best to make you look good. And still, some actors complain. Ah, well, chicken again today? Rick has never understood it. So, during his lunch half hour, when he can't eat, he might as well get himself familiar with the saloon set, where the gang of rustlers his character leads hangs out. Rick, in his full Caleb Descartu regalia, walks the 20th Century Fox Western backlot, which on this show is called Royo del Oro. When lunch is over, this place will be teeming with crew members, cowboys, filming equipment, and horses. But during lunch, it turns into a ghost town. It's not completely deserted. Random crew members cut through the Western set as a shortcut on their way to somewhere else. But by and large, it's deserted. As the actor walks in his costume and his boots down the dirt main street, surrounded by Wild West-type businesses, livery stables, general stores, a coffin maker, a fancy hotel, a shitty hotel, he starts getting a feel for Caleb Descartu. In the pilot, Caleb was the leader of a gang of bloodthirsty cattle rustlers, which the show referred to by the fancy moniker of land pirates, who'd moved into the Royo del Oro territory, poaching the cows of the biggest cattle rancher in the valley, Murdoch Lancer, at will. And with no law in the town to speak of, the nearest federal marshal over 150 miles away, and nothing but old man Lancer and a few Mexican ranch hands to shoo them off, that situation didn't look like it was going to change any time in the near future. However, as if the unabated poaching of Murdoch Lancer's cows wasn't bad enough, events had recently taken a turn for the lethal worst, with Caleb sending snipers at night to rain rifle fire upon the Lancer ranch house, where Murdoch's precious 8-year-old daughter Mirabella slept, and the bunkhouse, where the ranch hand slept, resulting in the murder of George Gomez, the Lancer ranch ramrod and Murdoch's oldest friend, and scaring off a quarter of Murdoch's men. Murdoch Lancer was desperate, and desperate times call for desperate measures. It would appear Murdoch's only alternative would be to hire a bunch of cutthroats of his own and engage in a bloody ranch war, which would leave many men dead, not to mention put his daughter in harm's way. Not only did Murdoch feel his money was not meant to finance murder, even scum, like the men of Descartu. Ultimately, old man Lancer felt the murder of men wasn't worth the price of bovine. So instead of doing the obvious, Murdoch Lancer took a turn toward the unique. The old man had two sons by two different mothers, shades of Bonanza, who he hadn't seen since they were children, and if their reputations could be trusted, both men seemed more than capable when it came to handling firearms. The oldest of the two, Scott Lancer, was the most impressive in the old man's eyes. Educated inside the hallowed halls of Harvard and raised in wealth, culture, and honor by the Fosters,
his mother's distinguished Boston family. Currently, in Murdoch's opinion, he was pissing away that pedigree by living the life of a riverboat gambler. There were also rumors of him killing the son of a United States senator in a pistol duel over the compromising of the honor of a beautiful Southern belle. However, the young man had a distinguished military career, riding with the British cavalry in India. When he left Calcutta and set sail for home, he returned with 2 medals for bravery in the face of the enemy and a limp in his right leg. John Lancer, Murdoch's youngest boy, was another case entirely. The last time Murdoch saw him was when the boy was 10 years old, after his mother Marta Conchita Luisa Galvedon Lancer had sex with one of her husband's ranch hands. She took their young son and fled into the night. Marta was a tramp, the way other people are drunks. It was what she was, but not necessarily what she wanted to be. But like a true honest-to-goodness drunk on the wagon, she might lay off her prowess at seduction and her susceptibility to same for a week or two, or a month or two, or a year or two. But her eventual fall was inevitable. In Marta's case, as Murdoch Lancer's wife and John Lancer's mother, she laid off for 10 years after the birth of her son. But eventually, the time came where she gave in to her true nature. The first time Marta saw handsome Lazaro Lopez astride a saddle, roping steers, she knew her fall from grace, wealth, and position was simply a matter of time. Marta might not have loved her husband, but as Tina Turner was later to sing, what's love got to do with it? 15-year-old girls fall in love with stable boys who don't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of, when wealthy landowners would gladly trade 12 good horses for their hand in marriage. Love is for young girls with their brains in their ass. What Marta felt for Murdoch was far more meaningful. Respect. When she humiliated him in his home, in the eyes of his men, she pulverized the thing that made his spine stand straight, his pride. She had played house for 10 years, but now he saw her for what she was, a filthy whore who could not be trusted. When he confronted her with her treachery, she saw in his eyes that the life they had created together on the Lancer Ranch was destroyed. Even if he did forgive her, he'd never forget. But even more catastrophic was the respect in herself she'd lost and would never regain. Murdoch Lancer had his problems, but he was a good man. And he didn't deserve a tramp who'd toss away the life he gave her for no better reason than a roll in the hay with some cocksure bronco buster. So once her husband went to sleep, she took their 10-year-old son and the buggy Murdoch had given her for her 28th birthday and ran off to Mexico. In the border towns of Mexico, she could stop pretending to be something other than what she was born to be. Unbeknownst to their little boy, Murdoch spent 5 years searching for his runaway wife and young son, all to a fruitless outcome. After a dissatisfied customer slit her throat 2 years later in the back room of an Ensenada cantina, Marta finally received the peace she craved since her transgression. Her self-degradation could come to an end. Her husband's pride could finally find restitution, and her son could finally be rid of the weight tied to his ankle that dragged him down to the lower depths of humanity. Since Jesus Christ was the only one who knew how badly she felt about what she had done, maybe he'd forgive her, like he always promised he would. Then she could finally leave behind the shacks, cantina back rooms, and whorehouses. A paradise where her sins would be washed away was what lay before her, if this whole Jesus business was to be believed. In some ways, Marta Lancer was the more fortunate one, because Murdoch never found peace with his sons lost to him. The old man felt terrible bitterness toward his first wife, Diane Foster Lancer, for her weakness and lack of fortitude. Making vows in the eyes of God at their wedding ceremony, she hadn't the strength of character to keep. To keep a promise was a test of oneself, a test that these women he brought into his life failed, and failed horribly. But at least in Scott's case, the old man knew he was safe, secure, and well-fed. He might grow up a dude, as opposed to a cattleman, and the heir to a self-made empire. But at least he would be well looked after by his China Plate Beacon Hill relatives. But poor John, God only knew what he lived through. After 5 years of searching, one of Lancer's Pinkerton detectives finally located Marta Galvadon Lancer's final resting place in a Boot Hill graveyard in Ensenada, Mexico. It was obvious that the wooden cross and her name carved on the board was carved by her surviving 12-year-old son. The old man journeyed to Ensenada. The last record of his son was his appearance at the murder trial of her killer, a Mexico City citizen of wealth and prestige. The affluent Mexican was acquitted under prejudicial circumstances by the biased jury, who seemed to have it in for Marta. The throat-slitting parasite could have set Marta on fire, and that jury wouldn't have found him guilty. And though Murdoch continued to search for the boy, all his efforts were in vain. When Murdoch signed his last check to the Pinkerton Detective Agency, it was with the bitter resolve that his son was dead. And that, apparently, was that. It was sometime around 15 years later that the reputation of a deadly half-white, half-Mexican gunfighter named Johnny Madrid reached the ears of Californians. The reputation was that of a scoundrel, but a scoundrel with a lightning-fast prowess with a pistola. From the accounts of eyewitnesses and dime store pulp writers, he had the quickness and killing of Tom Horn, the accuracy of aim of Annie Oakley, the nasty disposition of John Wesley Hardin, and the lack of human empathy of William H. Bonney. He was one of the most feared killers who rode the Mexican side of the border, known by the peons in the pueblos he passed through as El Asesino de Rojo. Translation, the murderer in red, due to the fancy red ruffled shirt he always wore. But it wasn't until 3 years ago that one of Lancer's former Pinkerton detectives sent him a telegram that informed the cattle baron that his long-lost son was indeed alive and living under the name Johnny Madrid. The old man cried for 3 days, with nobody on the ranch understanding why. However, now that Murdoch Lancer's battle with Caleb Decatu and his land pirates had graduated from the simple loss of cows to the tragic loss of life, it was only a matter of time before the cattle baron hired killers of his own. But before that inevitable day arrived, Murdoch had one crazy idea. He would track down and get word to his two long-lost sons, John and Scott. He'd wire them enough money to travel to Lancer Ranch, with an offer of $1,000 apiece for just listening to his proposition. His offer was simple. Help him defend the ranch against Caleb and his killers. And once they'd driven off these pirates, Murdoch would equally share his entire empire with his two sons. It was a generous offer, but it was no gift. They'd have to earn it, and they'd have to keep from getting killed by Caleb and his boys. But if they were willing to help Murdoch prevail against these rascals and were willing to put in the blood, sweat, and tears it took to run a successful ranch this size, all three Lancer men would be equal partners. And if all these things miraculously worked out, Murdoch Lancer and his long-lost sons would finally, at long last, be a family. All in all, not a bad premise for a TV series, Rick thought. Good story and good characters. A little reminiscent of Bonanza and The High Chaparral, but darker and more violent, more cynical. For one, Murdoch Lancer is no Ben Cartwright-like, stern but fair, compassionate patriarch. He's a real uncompromising son of a bitch. You can imagine both former wives getting fed up with his shit real quick and hightailing it away from this bitter bastard first chance they got. And the horse-faced actor, Andrew Duggan, who Rick did a play with once, they got to play Murdoch, doesn't have a folksy bone in his body. He's hard as a bar of iron and about as lovable. The character of Scott Lancer is more the likable good guy found on 60s Western shows, but his fancy Eastern dandy wardrobe definitely gives him a different look. He makes earlier dandies like Fat Masterson and Yancey Derringer look like saddle tramps. And his past as a former Bengal Lancer is an intriguing backstory. But it's Johnny Lancer, Johnny Madrid, that is the no-shit unique Western TV series lead. Dalton's Jake Cahill was about as anti-hero as Western TV series leads ever got. But Johnny Lancer, Johnny Madrid, at least in the pilot script, goes far further than Jake was ever allowed to go. The handsome, roguish, mysterious Johnny Lancer who steps off the Royo del Oro stage is the type of character that usually guest stars on Western TV shows, not stars in them. That type of character usually shows up on Bonanza's Ponderosa Ranch or Big Valley's Barkley Ranch or the Virginian's Shiloh Ranch. And they're young, cocky, sexy, and a little dubious. They make friends with little Joe or Heath or Trampas. But at some point, usually in the first act, we learn they have some sort of dark secret. They're either on the run from somebody or from something, or they're running from who they were or something they did or didn't do. Or they're in the area for some clandestine reason, usually revenge, planning a robbery, or to meet somebody from their past. We, the audience, know they're shady. But we also know we'll have to wait till the third act before we find out. Is the character a bad guy or a misunderstood good guy? And in the third act, Michael Landon or Lee Majors or Doug McClure either helps them redeem themselves or shoots them dead. These characters are always the best roles on the show, and the guys who specialized in playing them usually went on to become stars. Charles Bronson, James Coburn, Darren McGavin, Vic Morrow, Robert Culp, Brian Keith, and David Carradine. But the role of Johnny Lancer, while written like a guest star, is the no-shit lead of the fucking series. And he's not anything like any of the other cowboys riding the range on the big three networks. Whoever this fucking guy Jim Stacy is, Rick thinks, he sure fell into a big piss pot full of luck when he landed this role. But Caleb Descartu isn't just a standard issue heavy either. It's a damn good part. And he has some of the script's best dialogue. As he walks the dusty, deserted streets of Royo del Oro, Rick goes over some of his lines, making his way to the saloon on the Western backlot set. As he walks by one of the Western businesses on the main drag, he catches a glimpse of his reflection in the glass of one of the windows. The sight makes him stop for a moment and examine it. Looking at the end result in the makeup trailer mirror, surrounded by the wig girl and the wardrobe girl and the director, he wasn't that keen on the results.
Unless somebody reads it in TV Guide, who the fuck's gonna know it's me, is what Rick really thought. But now he's gotten a little more used to it, walking around, the boots feel good, seeing himself reflected in the Western-style picture window, surrounded by a Wild West environment. This look ain't bad. He liked the hat from the get-go, but it's the brown hippie jacket that's really growing on him. The fringe hanging off the sleeves is pretty swell. He starts pointing and gesturing with his arms and watching the effect in the window reflection. The way the dangling fringe emphasizes his movements is pretty neat. He can do a lot with that. Not too shabby, Rebecca, Rick thinks. He also thinks, it doesn't look like me. But maybe Sam's right. And that ain't such a bad thing. It does look like Caleb. Maybe not the Caleb I pictured in my mind when I first read the script. That Caleb looked like me. I mean, if they want me, they want it to look like me, right? But maybe Sam has a point. At least when Johnny Lancer kills me, he won't be killing Jake Cahill. But staring at Caleb in the window, staring back at Rick, he sees something else. He sees a little of what Marvin Chores was talking to him about in the office yesterday. At one point, he called Rick an Eisenhower actor in a Dennis Hopper Hollywood. Looking at his reflection in his whole Caleb Descartes regalia, he understands a little more clearly and a little less defensively what Marvin Chores was getting at. Shaggy-haired guys are the style of the day. And that guy in the window in the fringe jacket could be Michael Sarrazin. Sans Pompadour, Rick looks not only like a different character, but a different actor. He's worn his hair the same way for so long, somewhere along the line the Pompadour became him. But now, examining his reflection in the window without it, he doesn't look so much like an aging cowboy actor from the 50s anymore. He kind of looks like a withered modern actor. This guy isn't an Eisenhower relic. This guy could be in a Sam Peckinpah movie. After Rick tears himself away from his own reflection in the window and the reflections about his career in his head, he spots Caleb's commandeered saloon, the Gilded Lily, out of which his character runs his murderous gang of rustlers. As he approaches the front porch of the saloon set, he sees a director's chair with his character's name on it. On TV shows, series regulars get a director's chair with their actor's name written on it. But guest stars usually get chairs with their character's name on it, because oftentimes they're not cast till a few days before. Sitting next to his empty director's chair on the wooden walkway directly in front of the swinging saloon doors is the little girl dressed in the period clothes he saw talking to Sam when he first arrived. He doesn't know her real name and can't remember her character's name, but she plays Murdoch Lancer's 8-year-old daughter by yet another mother. But this one didn't skedaddle the first chance she got. Instead, she tragically broke her neck when she was thrown from the beautiful strawberry roan Murdoch gifted her for their third wedding anniversary. The same strawberry roan Murdoch Lancer shot in the head once he got home from her funeral. Later in the script, Caleb will kidnap the little girl and hold her for $10,000 ransom. The kidnapping of the child will end up being the emotional turning point in the story. While Johnny Lancer was brought to town by his father to defend the ranch against Caleb and his men, the screenwriters of the pilot had a twist in store for that standard scenario. One, Johnny hates the father he hasn't seen since he was 10 years old. And two, as luck would have it, unbeknownst to anybody on the ranch, Johnny Madrid and Caleb Descartes both know and like each other.
At any rate, he likes Caleb a damn sight better than the father he blames for the death of his mother. Getting revenge for his mother by killing his father has been a dream of the son since he buried her 18 years earlier in the Ensenada dirt. A revenge that Caleb Descartu is quite successfully executing, which ends up putting Johnny in the difficult but dramatically rewarding position of having to decide not only which side is he on, but who is he, Lancer or Madrid? With Caleb's kidnapping of the child being the emotional catalyst that ultimately pushes Johnny over to the side of the Angels and sets him up for a weekly Western television show alongside his newfound family. Rick has a scene with the young actress later today where he negotiates his ransom demands with Scott Lancer as the little girl sits on his lap with a pistol barrel pressed against the side of her temple. But it's tomorrow when he and the little girl will have their biggest scene together. As he examines the little dishwater blonde from a distance, sitting in her director's chair reading a big black hardcover book, she looks to be about 12 years old. She's spending her lunchtime sitting on the set by herself, with no adult guardian or no sign of a lunch. She doesn't raise her eyes from the book she's reading when he walks up to the saloon's front porch steps. Not even after he clears his throat and says, "Hello?" "Oh boy," he thinks. "This little bitch is going to be a pip." Hitting his greeting much harder, he repeats, "Hello!" Raising her eyes from the book opened up in her lap, apparently annoyed, she says, "Hello," to the hairy cowboy standing at the bottom of the porch steps. Holding up the Western paperback in his hand, he asks her, "Would it bother you if I sat next to you and read my book too?" She looks at him poker-faced, with the bitchy timing of a pint-sized Betty Davis. "I don't know. Would you bother me?" That was pretty clever, Rick thinks. What, does this little squirt walk around with a team of gag writers supplying her bitchy comebacks to rhetorical questions? "I'll try not to," Rick softly replies. She lays the big black book on her lap and examines him for a moment, then turns to the empty director's chair, examines it, and looks back at Rick again. "That's your chair, ain't it?"
"Yep,"
Rick says. "Who am I to tell you not to sit in your chair?" Removing his cowboy hat and giving her a gracious bow, "Nevertheless," he says, pouring on the charm, "I thank you kindly." She neither giggles nor smiles, just lowers her eyes back to her reading material. Fuck this fucking little cunt, Rick thinks. So noisier than need be, his cowboy boots clomp up the wooden steps of the porch. He heads to his director's chair, climbs himself backward into the seat, making the slight moaning sound he always makes when he climbs himself backward into his director's chair. She ignores him. He then removes his fucked-up pack of cigarettes from his black Levi's pants pocket, takes one from the sweaty, crumpled pack, and sticks it in his mouth underneath the horsetail glued to his upper lip. He lights his cancer stick with his silver Zippo in that flashy, noisy way of a 50s-era cool daddy-o. After he's accomplished setting the end on fire, he slams the lid of the Zippo closed with what looks like a diagonal karate chop. Metal slams down on metal with a loud snap. She ignores him. He takes a big drag of his cigarette, filling his lungs with smoke, the way when he was a younger actor he used to watch Michael Parks do. Only in hungover Rick's case, the exhale triggers a coughing fit. which causes him to cough up another one of his green mixed with crimson loogies, which splatters in a colorful glob on the wooden walkway. That she doesn't ignore. A look of horror crosses the little lady's little face, as if Rick just pissed in her Wheaties. She stares in disbelief at both Rick and the gooey loogie refuse on the ground. Okay, that was a little too much, Rick thinks. So he sincerely apologizes to his little co-star. She tries to blink the image out of her eyes as her head lowers back down to find the place in the big black book where she left off. The fact is, after assuring her he'd try not to bother her while she was reading, he's frankly done nothing but. And he's still not through. Pretending to read his paperback, as he tries to mask that he's digging a stubborn booger lodged up his nose, he asks her casually, "You don't eat lunch?" She answers back flatly, "I've got a scene after lunch." Rick asks her, "Yeah," as if he's saying, "So?" Now he finally gets her attention. So she closes the book, lays it in her lap, and turns to explain to him her methodology. "Eating lunch before I do a scene makes me sluggish. I believe it's the job of an actor, and I say actor, not actress, because the word actress is nonsensical. It's the actor's job to avoid impediments to their performance. It's the actor's job to strive for 100% effectiveness. Naturally, we never succeed. But it's the pursuit that's meaningful." Rick just stares at her for a beat or two without saying anything, till he finally says, "Who are you?" "You can call me Mirabella," she says. "Mirabella what?" he asks. "Mirabella Lancer," she says, obviously. Rick waves that away with his hand and asks, no, I mean, what's your real name?" Again, she answers in tutorial-like fashion. "When we're on set, I'd prefer to only be referred to by my character's name. It helps me invest in the reality of the story. I've tried it both ways, and I'm just a tiny bit better when I don't break character. And if I can be a tiny bit better, I want to be." Rick doesn't really have anything to say back to that, so he just smokes. The young girl who calls herself Mirabella Lancer looks the cowboy bedecked in the fringed rawhide jacket up and down with her eyeballs and says, "You're the bad guy. Caleb Descartu," she says, not asks. And she pronounces the name like Jean Cocteau. Rick blows out some more cigarette smoke and says, "I thought it was pronounced Caleb Dakota." As she turns back to her big black book, Mirabella says, like a know-it-all smarty pants, "I'm pretty sure it's pronounced Descartu." Watching her read her book, he asks sarcastically, "What's so interesting?" She looks up from the book, not getting the sarcasm. "Huh? What are you reading?" he asks again, minus the sarcasm. The serious little girl does a serious spike in girlish enthusiasm as she excitedly bubbles. "It's a biography on Walt Disney. It's fascinating," she reviews. Then she opines to her fellow actor, "He's a genius, you know? I mean, a once in every 50 or 100 years kind of genius." Finally, Rick asks the question he's dying to know. "What are you, 12? She shakes her head no. She's used to adults making that mistake, and she likes it when they do. "I'm 8. She hands the big black book about Walt Disney over to Rick for him to examine. He looks down at the book and thumbs through the pages, asking her, "You understand all these words?" "Not all of them," she admits. But half the time, the context of the sentence gives you a pretty good idea of the meaning. And the words I really, really can't figure out, I make a list of and ask my mom. Impressed as he hands the book back to the little girl, he says, "Not too shabby. 8 years old, your own series." As she retrieves the book to her lap, she qualifies his compliment. "Lancer's hardly my series. It's Jim, Wayne, and Andy's series. I'm just the little tyke series regular." Then, pointing her tiny index finger at the actor, she tells him, "But just you wait. One of these days, I'm gonna get a series of my own. And when I do," she warns, "watch out." This little girl is unfucking believable, Rick thinks. In his career, he's met and worked with a lot of unbelievable child actors. But before Lily Langtree here, the most unbelievable one he ever saw was an 11-year-old boy whose name he sure as shit don't remember, but who he'll never forget. The year before he landed Bounty Law, he was cast in a series pilot that never was picked up. It was called Big Sky Country. And it starred boring 50s leading man Frank Lovejoy. It was a story of a widowed town sheriff, Frank Lovejoy, and his family. Rick played the oldest son, and there was an 11-year-old brother and a 9-year-old sister. The show was passed on by the network, but it was produced by the television company Four Star Productions and was screened once for the makers at their screening room. At the screening, which Rick attended, he bumped into the little boy who played his younger sibling in the men's room at Four Star. Rick headed for the urinal as the little boy finished washing his hands in the sink. If the series had been picked up, and if it had been successful, these two would have worked together for the next 5 years or longer. Rick would have watched this little boy turn into a teenager, and maybe a man before his eyes. The young lad would become either like a real brother to him, or just an annoying younger colleague, or maybe both. Because of this association, they could have been linked together for the rest of their lives. Or like what happened, the show doesn't get picked up, and this is the last time in their lives they'll ever see each other. As Rick removed his pecker from his pants and pointed it at the urinal wall, he asked over his shoulder how his young co-star was doing. The little actor told him as he harshly wiped the wetness from his hands with a paper towel. "Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm getting rid of my fucking agent, that's for goddamn sure." As Rick remembers that kid, this kid asks him, "What are you reading?" Referring to the paperback Western in his hand. He shrugs his shoulders and tells her, "It's just a Western." "What does that mean?" she asks, not understanding the initial dismissal. "Is it any good?" she inquires. He answers, far less enthusiastic about his book than she is with hers, "Yeah, it's pretty good." She wants more. "What's the story?" "I ain't finished it yet," he answers. "Jeez," she thinks, "this guy is so literal." "I didn't ask for the whole story," she emphasizes, trying another avenue of investigation. "What's the premise of the story?" The book is called Ride a Wild Bronc, and it's written by Marvin H. Albert, who wrote a pretty good book about the Apache Wars that Rick liked called Apache Rising, which was turned into a pretty mediocre movie with James Garner and Sidney Poitier titled Duel at Diablo. So Rick thinks about the story of this new book for a moment, gets the facts in the right order, and then proceeds to relate them to the young girl. "Well, it's about this guy who's a bronco buster, and it's a story of his life. Guy's name is Tom Breezy, but everybody just calls him Easy Breezy.
So when Easy Breezy was in his 20s and young and good-looking, he could break any horse you could throw at him. Back then, well, he just had a way, you know what I mean?
Yeah, she answers. He had a gift for breaking horses.
Yeah, that's right, he tells her. He had a gift. So anyway, he gets into his late 30s, and he takes a bad fall. Now, he ain't crippled or anything like that, but his lower section ain't ever the same. Now he's got spine problems he never had before. Now he spends more of his days in pain than he ever did before.
Jeepers, she interjects. This sounds like a good novel.
He sort of concurs. It ain't bad.
Where are you in it? She asks.
About midway, he answers.
She asks, what's happening to Easy Breezy now?
Rick's been reading pulp Western paperbacks since he was 12 years old. And ever since he became an actor, it's what he does in between takes and in his trailer, waiting for the second AD to summon him to set. He'll mix it up a little with a detective story, or a mystery, or World War II adventure, but the pulps he keeps returning to are the Westerns. Even though he likes them, he doesn't really remember them. He remembers the names of the authors he likes. The aforementioned Albert, Elmer Leonard, T.V. Olson, Ralph Hayes, but not the book titles. Considering how generic those titles were, The Texan, Gringo, The Outlaw, Ambush, Two Guns for Texas, that's perfectly understandable. But all the years sitting around on sets reading Westerns, while somebody may have asked him what he was reading, nobody ever asked him to recite the story. Though Rick never really thought about it before, he kind of now realizes that reading Western paperbacks is one of the most solitary activities that he partakes in. So being asked to explain to somebody what's happening now in the book he's reading is not something he's used to articulating. But for her sake, he tries his best. Well, he's not the best anymore, clarifying. In fact, far from it. And he's coming to terms with... Rick thinks, what's the right word to describe Easy Breezy's conundrum? What it's like to become a slightly more a... He opens his mouth to say the word useless, but the only thing that comes out of his mouth is a loud sob. The sob catches Rick by surprise and gets Mirabella's attention. He opens his mouth and tries again to say useless, but the word sticks in his throat. On his third attempt, he croaks out, useless each day, followed by a stream of tears that leak out of his eyes and run down his hairy face, folding him up like a jackknife. Oh, great, he thinks. Now I'm crying in front of children about my fucked up life. Holy shit, I've turned into my Uncle Dave. As fast as she can, Mirabella is out of her director's chair and on her knees at Rick's feet, patting his right kneecap in an effort to comfort him. As his fist violently wipes away the wetness around his eyes, with both embarrassment and self-loathing, he chuckles to indicate to the small child he's okay. Boy, I must be getting old. I can't talk about nothing touching without getting all choked up. The little girl thinks she understands and continues to console the weepy cowboy, who is now, in her eyes, starting to resemble the cowardly lion.
It's okay, Caleb. It's okay, she assures him. It sounds like a really sad book.
Shaking her head in sympathy, poor Easy Breezy, she shrugs her shoulders and says,
I'm practically crying, and I haven't even read it.
He says under his breath, wait till you're 15, you'll be living it.
She doesn't understand and asks, what?
He plasters a smile under his glued-on mustache and says, nothing, pumpkin puss. I'm just teasing.
Then holding up his Western paperback, he proclaims, and you know, you might be right. Maybe this book hits harder than I gave it credit for. The little girl's eyes narrow, and she gets back on her feet, rising to her full height, and informs him, I don't like names like Pumpkin Puss, but since you're upset, we'll talk about that some other time.
He laughs slightly to himself at her reaction as she climbs back into her director's chair next to him. Once she's back sitting comfortably in her chair, she looks Rick up and down in all his hairy-faced, brown rawhide fringe jacket glory.
So this is your Caleb Descartu look, huh?
Yeah, what do you think? You not like it?
No, you look groovy.
Yeah, she's right. It's not so bad, he thinks.
It's just, I didn't know Caleb was supposed to look groovy.
Oh, shit, I fucking knew it, Rick thinks. Do I look too much like a hippie?
Well, the little actor contemplates, I wouldn't say too much.
But I look like a hippie, the big actor clarifies.
Well, she asks, confused. That's the idea, ain't it?
Apparently, Rick dismissively snorts. The little actor gives a more elaborate evaluation of her first impression.
Look, that's not what I thought when I first read the script, but it's not a bad idea. Taking him in more with both her eyes and her eye toward characterization. In fact, the more I look at it, the more I like it.
Really? Rick asks. Then he challenges her. Why?
Well, the 8-year-old thinks, just for me, I find hippies kinda sexy, kinda creepy. And kind of scary. And sexy, creepy, and scary is a pretty strong choice for Caleb.
Rick snorts again and thinks, what does this little twerp know about sexy? But her words do calm him down about his anxiety over his Caleb Descartu look. Now that Rick's questions have been answered, Mirabella's got a few questions of her own.
Caleb, may I ask you something personal?
His one-word answer is, shoot.
She asks a question of her fellow actor that she seriously would like to know the answer to. What's it like playing the bad guy?
Well, it's actually pretty new for me, he tells her. I used to have my own cowboy show once, and on that show I played the good guy.
Which do you like playing better? She asks.
The good guy, he says without any ambiguity.
But, the little girl counters, Charles Laughton said that villains are the best parts.
Of course that's what that fat queer would say, Rick thinks. But instead of talking to a little girl about fat fags, he tries to explain to her why he prefers playing the good guy. Look, when I was a kid and played cowboys and Indians, I didn't pretend I was some damn Injun. I was the cowboy. Besides, the hero gets to kiss the lead actress. Or, in the case of a TV series, that week's female guest star. Heroes get the love scenes. Closest thing to a love scene a villain gets is when they let you rape somebody. And the bad guy always loses the fight to the good guy.
So what? She says. It's not a real fight.
Yeah, but people watch it, he explains. And now they think that guy can beat me up. She rolls her little eyes and says,
Well, then good. That means they believe the story.
It's embarrassing, he emphasizes.
Oh my God, she thinks this guy is incredible. How old are you?
She asks him in exasperation. I'm sure too old to be thinking like that.
Hey, calm down, he tells her. When people ask me what I like better, I assume there ain't no right or wrong answer.
That actually makes sense to the young actor's sense of fair play.
You know what, Caleb? You're 100% right.
He gives her a head nod that serves as a thank you. Then she reminds him of something.
You know, our big scene is tomorrow.
Yeah, remembering. Our big scene together is tomorrow, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And in that scene, you yell at me and grab me and scare me.
He assures her, don't be scared, I won't hurt you.
She qualifies her instruction with the caveat,
well, I don't want you to really hurt me.
Then she zeroes in on Rick and points her little finger at him.
But I want you to scare me.
She continues intensely.
Yell at me as loud as you want. Grab me hard, shake the shit out of me, scare me. Don't make me act scared, make me react scared. Anything less, she explains, and you're treating me like a baby, and I don't like it when adults treat me like a baby.
After her intense finger pointing, she slips back to her normal snotty demeanor.
The scene we do tomorrow, I want to put on my reel. And the only reason I can't put scenes on my reel that I want to is because the adults in the scenes aren't good enough. Don't use my age as an excuse to be anything less than great. Okay?
Okay, he says.
Promise?
She insists.
I promise. He assures her.
Let's shake on it, she suggests.
Having reached an understanding, the two actors shake hands. Chapter 13. The Sweet Body of Deborah. While everybody in the stunt community knows Cliff Booth is Rick Dalton's stunt double, it's not the thing he's most known for. It's just the most legitimate thing in the stunt community he's known for. On the list of things that Cliff Booth is known for, it ranks about number 4. The number 1 thing he used to be known for was his incredible military record, having more confirmed kills of Japanese enemy soldiers than any other American serviceman fighting in the Pacific Theater is one hell of a feat. And that's just confirmed kills. Ask any of his Filipino brother resistance fighters how many unconfirmed kills of Japanese